You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farm's WGXC 90.7 FM radio for open ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director at the John Cage Trust, and my guest today is Tom Moore, a renowned interpreter of Cage's music, in particular the composer's post-1951 works for solo piano and chamber music. Tom first met John Cage in 1982 and subsequently completed his master's thesis on Cage's Amores. It was a happy relationship, and in 1990, Cage remarked, "I am delighted that Thomas Moore plays my music, studies and thinks, writes and talks about it. He is an excellent musician, one in whom I have confidence and whose work I enjoy." The solo piano work, As Slow as Possible, or ASLSP, from 1985, not to be confused with Organ 2, ASLSP for organ, dating from 1987, was written by Cage at Tom's request and was a compulsory piece at the 1985 University of Maryland International Piano Festival and Competition. In the 1970s and 80s, Tom produced weekly new music programs for public radio stations in the Baltimore, Washington area, beginning at the legendary WGTB-FM, that featured interviews with not only John Cage, but composers Robert Ashley, David Berman, Morton Feldman, Philip Glass, Alvin Lucier, Conlon Nancarrow, Pauline Olivero, Steve Reich, Roger Reynolds, David Tudor, and others. He has enthusiastically also taken up Cage's interest in mushrooms and recently gave a talk on Cage's fascination with fungi that can be experienced on YouTube. He has recently been invited to serve on the board of the Mycological Association of Washington, D.C. Tom's performances can be heard on Numa Records, Chen Li Music, 10 West Records, OO Discs, and Spectrum Records. For almost 27 years, he has been the Director of Arts and Culture in Institutional Advancement at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, a hotbed of new music where Cage's works are often performed and always enjoyed. Welcome to All Things Cage, Tom. It's a pleasure to have you here.
It's great to see you again, Laura. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Doing well, thanks.
Excellent. Tom and I had the great fortune to be together for several days in a row in earlier November in Asheville, North Carolina, part of God's country. It's so beautiful there. And it was the 12th annual Reviewing Black Mountain College International Conference. And I was there doing a keynote conversation with Jeff Arnell, who's been a guest on All Things Cage before. And Tom was there doing a performance of a work that continues to give me and others a considerable amount of confusion. So I thought this is a really nice opportunity to bring Tom in, and we're going to talk about this and see if he has any confusion that he'd like to toss into the mix. And that is, Tom performed the haikus from 1950 to 51, which itself is comprised of five very short pieces. The shortest is 10 seconds, the longest is 25 seconds. This was the first set of haikus that Cage wrote of the three that we know of. But why I say it's given me a lot of confusion over the years is that people every now and then show up in my life with a haiku that doesn't fit into any of these compositions. So Tom made the nice observation in our talking about doing this program that maybe the haikus were like Cage's misostics, in that when he met somebody and liked them a lot, he wrote them a haiku. That's possible, I suppose. Anyway. So Tom gave this beautiful performance of these very, very short, sweet, tender works and put up the published scores of them, which are artworks unto themselves. They're so beautiful and so simple to look at that it was a big hit that he did these. And it was the first time that I had ever heard the work performed live. So thank you very much.
It was the first time I had performed them. And the first time I had heard them either. So,
okay. So what brought you to the haikus? How did you get there?
That happened sort of by mishap, because I was performing at Black Mountain College Museum and Arts Center also in October. Jeff Arnall had invited me down there twice this fall. And I was planning to play a number of works from the early 50s by Cage on the second program. And Jeff said to me in October that he was going to get the piano tuned before my concert. And I said, well, could you make sure the sostenuto pedal's working correctly? Because Cage uses the sostenuto pedal extensively in the haikus and the pastorals and in water music, which I was performing. And he said, well, hang on. And he walked over to the piano and he said, explain to me how it should work. Jeff is a percussionist, right? So I walked him through it and he said, well, there is a pedal, but there's no rod connecting it to the dampers. So we discovered there really wasn't a working sostenuto pedal. And I had planned to play the seven haiku. So I had to set them aside along with some other things. And I was digging around through Cage's works from the early 50s, trying to see what I could perform. And these haiku popped up, and I thought, what are those? I had never heard of them before. And apparently, they were published after Cage's death by Don Gillespie, who edited the manuscripts that he had found. So they were written in the late 50s and, I'm sorry, late 1950 and early 1951, just before Cage began to work on Music of Changes. And also during the time that he was attending D.T. Suzuki's lectures at Columbia in March 51. So, as you said, they're very beautiful little expressive pieces. There are seven of them in Don's published score, five of which are numbered, and he attaches the other two in an addendum. So I only played the first five.
Oh, Tom, I wonder if those are the two that he wrote for Morrow.
Well, that could be.
Oh, wouldn't that be amazing? I found I
One
was
is.
sharing with Tom this morning, right before we started recording this program, that I came across a letter in the selected letters of John Cage that he's making reference in a letter to David Tudor from mid-51, wherein he says, I've finished two more haikus for Morrow, who gave a performance of them, but it gave me pause because I didn't know if he meant for her to play or for her like a named recipient. But you have two extras. Where's Don when we need him?
Yes. And is there a date on that letter? Do you
No,
know?
there is
Oh, okay.
not. So
There are
we
no dates on.
estimated it early June 1951.
There are no dates on the other haiku either. So it could
No.
be that those are, in fact, the ones written for Morrow.
Well, it's even more confounding. So for our audience, Cage did three so titled works, the haikus from 50-51. Then we have seven haiku from 51-52. And then we have a single haiku from 1958. So there are seven. You're saying there are seven in the published book of what should be five haiku.
Correct.
And there are seven, as there should be seven, in the seven haiku
That's
publication.
right. Yes.
Well, that's really interesting, isn't it?
So there are two sets of seven haiku, essentially. Yeah. And
But
I was quite confused at first because I thought, what are these? And so when I got the score in the mail, because I ordered it from Peters, I was really delighted. They're not at all like the later seven haiku. And Don mentions in his preface, there's a long introductory essay he writes that the structure of these is 757, and
And
haikus are 575.
that's right. And that's an important distinction, which is that error saying it's the traditional haiku scheme of 757. No, 575 is it's repeated everywhere, including at the Philadelphia Museum of Art that has one of the originals. And they say, oh, yes, it follows the haiku scheme of 575. But I don't think it does. I think they follow 757, which is the haiku scheme that is generally attributed to haikus that are known as hakus, HOKKU, I believe. But I'm not expert in haikus. So it's just confusion out there around this work.
One of the remarkable things about these pieces is that Don mentions that the first measure and a half of the first haiku is on the title page of the manuscript of 16 Dances. And there's no thematic content that's similar, but they have a similar sound to them. And what that's doing on the title page of 16 Dances is not clear.
Right. There are many instances in the music manuscript collection where something appears on the backside or indeed on the front side of something where Cage begins work. He was also a great recycler. So if there was paper to be recycled, he would use that. So people have gone to great lengths to connect what they're looking at with what's on the back of it or what's written on the bottom, as if they go together. The Dances comes from when? That's 51, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Same time period.
It's the same time. So it could have just been refuse, you know, that he was just reusing paper.
Oh, that could be.
Yeah.
Also in the margin of Haiku 5 is Arnold Schoenberg's Los Angeles address. And Schoenberg died in June or July 51, you know, sometime during the summer. So I wonder if he was in touch with Schoenberg then or not.
No, I think it was, it could be. It could be. I don't know. That's a different topic.
It is. Anyway, these are really delightful pieces, and I'm looking forward to playing them again.
I found them so when I heard you play them. And as I said, that was the first time. And now you're going to undertake the 7 haiku. Yes.
I play the 7 haiku, but I couldn't play them at Black Mountain. And that's why I ended up playing these others.
So, I see.
Yeah.
And by the way, just for our audience, just to connect the dots here, Cage was at Black Mountain College in this little window that Morty Feldman spoke of so sweetly. He called it, there was a very short period in which we didn't have a clue what we were doing and it was marvelous. And that was the 49 to 52 window where they really didn't know what they were doing. And they, you know, graphic notation was spilling out of people and Cage was developing chance operations. And there was all this stuff going on. But what was also going on is that Cage and Cunningham were spending time at Black Mountain College. So hence Jeff Arnall wanting Tom to play twice. It was because there were events going on across this international conference, the Reviewing Black Mountain 12, that were happening in tandem with the UNC campus, the University of North Carolina in Asheville campus, that were connected. And I'm assuming, Tom, you played at the Faith and Arts?
That's correct, at Faith and Arts.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and Faith and Arts paired at UNC, paired with Jeff Arnall and Black Mountain College Museum and Arts Center, which he directs, to produce a little chapbook called John Cage Zen and Friends or something like that. I don't have it in front of me. Did you get one?
I did.
Oh, good.
I was so delighted. I saw it. I thought, I've never seen this before.
No, that was its debut. And that book was done sort of to honor, to celebrate, to introduce the topic of Cage and Zen, which was also the subject of a beautiful exhibition that was at the Black Mountain College Museum and Arts Center, where you gave your concert, except that it had been slightly obscured because all the furniture had to be moved. So nobody could actually see the show until you were finished. And that was the work of
exhibition.
Jane Dellinger, who's also been a guest on All Things Cage.
Yes, and it's a beautiful exhibition. And it's up until January or February, something like that.
I think it's January, but well into January. And so that was the first little publication that Faith and Arts and Jeff Arnall, Black Mountain College Museum and Arts Center, did in tandem with each other. And they just wanted to do these little chapbooks to kind of be in tandem with these various exhibitions, these various things that were going on across this duration. When you were there in October, was Ray Cass's show up at the Asheville Museum of Art?
It may have been. I was sort of in and out so quickly. I didn't really have a chance to get around and see anything.
Okay. Well, his show was up, but it was over and down by the time I got into town. So it closed like at the end of October, I think. And that was a Ray Cass show, really celebrating the rural art tradition of Mountain Lake Workshop and working with local artists in Virginia, which is where Cage made all of his watercolor. So anyway,
yes, that's and I wish I had seen that. You know, the New River watercolors in particular were just so spectacular. And there were so many of them. People don't know, but there were over 50 of them.
Oh, I think there were more than that.
Yeah.
I do, because it was across four series. Those dated from 88 and 90, but he made a few works in 83 when Ray first started to get him to come. It took 5 years for Cage to go and be, you know, in residence. He's done a show. Ray Cass has done a show. Look at all these people who have done a show. They're all connected. We're all connected. One big circle. Anyway, so you were going to play the seven haiku at this concert? The Faith and Arts concert?
I was planning to play them at the reviewing
Black Mountain.
Because my thinking had been to focus on works that Cage wrote in and around the time he was there.
Of course.
You know, 52, 53. And there's some beautiful pieces for solo piano written right around that time.
That's great.
And it was also as Cage began to get to know David Tudor. You know, you can tell that these haiku were written for Cage the pianist, not David Tudor the pianist, in a way.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. It's curious, though. I stumbled across something which I think you and I have talked about in the past, that it looks like David Tudor was the dedicatee of the 58 haiku. That is, haiku for DT is written on the envelope that the manuscript is contained in. That's number one. I sent that to you, I think, the whole thing.
Yes.
But I also found reference to his giving the first performance of that piece, David Tudor, at the Los Angeles Cage celebration in honor of Cage's 75th birthday in 1987. I think that's the first performance.
Wow.
Yeah. And it gets even more confusing. Do you want more confusion?
Yes, but it's astonishing that a piece that was written in 1958 got its first performance in 1986.
Yeah, it says first performance, but it also says as electronic web, on electronic web. Now, I'm assuming that's the reference to the whole Earth electronic link, because the date 87, it must be 87, right? Because Cage was 75th birthday. 87 would have been around the time that he was embarking on the first meeting of the Satie Society, right? With Ben Schiff. And that, but before that, he was contemplating doing that piece, that the first meeting of the Satie Society on the internet. It was going to be the first kind of collection of contributions in various media for gifts for Satie. So it's called the first meeting of the Satie Society. Anyway, that was electronic link. And it would be very much like Cage to call it electronic web. You know what I mean?
Because it would be. You know, well, he did publish it's hard to even describe what the first meeting of the Satie Society
I know.
Is because it existed in so many forms.
That's exactly right. And it's hard to do a show where you don't have visuals to try to, a picture's worth a thousand words in the case of that work. If, you know, it's all well and good to describe it, but.
Well, in 1985, he published on the Whole Earth Electronic Link.
Otherwise known as The Well.
The Well,
Whole Earth, yes. Electronic Link, yes.
Yes, actually it was on the ArtCom network on The Well.
Exactly.
This big chunk of text, you know, tons of misostics and so on, that was basically the first meeting of the Satie Society, saying that... I think in his intro, because I actually have it here, he said, the first meaning of the Satie Society is here made accessible for any use one has for it. We are getting rid of ownership, substituting use.
Right. And then he went on to abandon the internet venue.
Yes.
And started to work with Ben Schiff and Osiris Publications and made a beautiful Marcel Duchamp inspired cracked glass valise with little Thoreau quotations hand stamped into. Have you ever seen one of these, Tom?
I have not. And I remember talking to John about this project, you know, in the mid 80s or something. And he, at first it was going to be a sort of a box that you opened up, you know, sort of this Duchampian thing.
It is.
By Rauschenberg and Cy Twombly and all sorts of people. This sounds fascinating, you know, and he kept saying
Twombly.
Well, he kept saying Cy Twombly was dragging his feet.
Right. So Twombly in the end didn't. There are letters in the selected letters all about this.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was Saul LeWitt, Rauschenberg, mm-hmm. Robert Ryman, Jasper Johns, Mel Daniel, who was married to Minna Daniel, Minna Lederman. Mm-hmm. Cage himself does one of the variation series is used as, anyway, and it's got Mesostic poems for each. I think there are 7 books, and Cage did the poetry based, Mesostic poems based on other people.
Yes, and the Mesostics are presents to Satie from Duchamp and Joyce and McLuhan, exactly. And Chris Mann, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, no, I've never seen the final rendering of this, but it was not finished when Cage passed away, was it?
That's correct. And I actually worked with Ben Schiff for, I don't know, in the first decade after Cage's death to try to bring it to some closure, because Ben had a hard time finishing this work. I'm not exactly sure why. And the edition number changed, which was really unfortunate because the work had already been acquired by the New York Public Library Rare Book Collection, which had a certain description, which included the edition number. And then Ben started changing the edition number, which you don't, it's a real no-no in the visual art world. I don't know what happened in the end, truly. However, I can tell you that we have, the John Cage Trust has one. So if you ever want to come and visit us,
next time I'm up there, that's the first thing I'll go take a look at.
Exactly. You can, yeah. You know, we have a little guest room. You can spend the night and you can hang out with the first meeting of the Satie Society to your heart's content. But anyway, lovely. We've gotten a little bit off track here. Going back, all I was saying is that the first performance of the 1958 haiku, which is very different from the first and second publications of haikus, which are much, they're both for solo piano, they're very short, they are dedicated to people or named for people. This one is for unspecified instrumentation. It can be done in any way. It's purely graphic with instructions. It's unpublished to date. So this is simply a reference I found in a letter that Cage wrote. No. This is in the John Cage chronology that we use here. It's not infallible. I'm letting myself off the hook here. If we make some fantastic discovery that this is a reference to something else, but we show it as first performed by David Tudor at John Cage Celebration 75th Birthday Los Angeles Festival in September of 1987, and then after the performed by David Tudor, it says on electronic web.
Who knows? So,
I know, curious, huh?
You know, the internet as we know it now didn't exist back then. There was no streaming anything.
Right.
And right. You couldn't really even upload a sound file anywhere at that time very easily. So
yes, I don't know what's meant by it. It's curious, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'll send you a copy of this letter.
I'd love a copy of the letter.
Anyway, but moving on. So you were going to play the 7 haiku, which followed. It was the second work of haikus that Cage wrote. The 7 haikus are more, I guess I was going to say noteworthy in the sense that they are attributed to people that Cage was close to at the time, a couple of whom remain mysterious because they're just, as I was telling Tom this morning, one of them is for Elsa. I have no idea who Elsa is or was. There's another name that I can't even pronounce. It looks like, let me see if I can do it and not murder it. Aghavni Uomi. Uomini. Yes. Aghavni Uomini. I don't know who that is. I have no idea.
So if anybody listening knows,
that's right. That's right. If that means anything to anybody, and I haven't done any kind of Google searching. So if forgive me if it's like plain as the nose on my face, you know. But it's Willem de Kooning, Sonia Sekula, Mauro Ajimian, who performed the work, Richard Lippold, the sculptor, and Merle Armitage are the other 5. And then we have Elsa and we have Agnavi.
Yes.
So it's more noteworthy in the sense that Cage was sort of I suppose he fleshed out the form with the first set of five or seven.
Or seven, yes. Sure.
And then kind of hit his stride with the second, which he then titled Seven Haiku. And then the last one simply called Haiku and it's unpublished. So if you want to perform it, you can
I hope Peters. I hope Peters eventually publishes that. And, yeah. And how many, you know, just out of curiosity, how many unpublished works of Cage are there?
Not a lot. But and there were, as you said, you know, the original haikus were published after Cage's death. So that entailed having a kind of advisory board, you know, a kind of a group of people who kind of look at something. And Don was key to that process in the years. Don died when? 2007?
Sounds about right. Maybe 2008, sometime around then.
It was that long ago, huh?
I think so.
Maybe.
Wasn't it?
I don't know. I can look this up very quickly. But Don was key, having been at C.F. Peters for a really, really long time.
Yeah, he was really the champion of Cage's music there.
All right, hang on. I'm going to do this again.
Why is it that we both thought that he died so much sooner?
Well, he disappeared so much sooner.
Well, that's true.
You know, he moved to Georgia.
Oh, no, I have him here. Don Gillespie died 2019. Maybe there was a different Don Gillespie, but still.
2019?
Yeah.
Well, we're going to have to, we'll work on this later. We might actually cut this out. Now we're introducing more and more chaos here.
Talk about confusion. There, I sent you a link in the chat.
Yeah. Yeah. Now I'm really confused. I'm going to open this up really quick. Oh, reopen last window. Yep. 2019, October 24th. You were right. It's 2019, but still. It was like a year and a half ago, 2 years ago.
I guess it's because he retired so long back. And
he retired. Gene reminded me that he retired when C.F. Peters moved from New York City to Glendale in Queens. Mm-hmm. And Don just said no way, that he couldn't do that commute. And he had gotten married.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. He married a German musicologist by the name of Sabina Feist, who I think she's still teaching at Arizona State University, but she had moved to Arizona. So his whole life was kind of upside down anyway. He had married, she moved to Arizona. His business that he had been working in for so long was going to Queens, where he had no relationships in Queens. So he went back to Georgia, to where he was from, and moved into a family home. And then years after he had done that, suffered a house fire, which destroyed virtually everything he had. He ended up in a nursing home. And then I think he just stayed in the nursing home after that and passed away a couple of years after. It was tragic.
Sorry to hear all that. I had no idea. Yeah.
It was not good for him. But I made it my mission in life, for all the time after he retired, and particularly so when he was suffering from illness and hardship, that whenever a new book came out about Cage or a new recording, I would get an extra one and I would send it to Don. And I came to find out, and Don really appreciated this, but I came to learn years later from Gene that in the fire, Don had lost everything, all the print matter that he had, which included the entire Cage publication library that he had. And it was around that time that Don had written to Gene, who replaced him when he left, and asked him if he could have a set, which is, we're talking hundreds of scores here. And the powers that be in the New York office, in the Glendale office, said no. And Gene went to bat for Don and said, this is for Don, you guys. I know it's a lot. I know it's a lot to ask, but this is Don and we're going to do this. And it got done.
Oh, that's really lovely.
Isn't it?
And it is a huge amount of material. You know, the 1962 Peters catalog that was put together by Bob Dunn, Robert Ellis Dunn.
Sure.
And in exchange for doing that, they gave him a copy of all of Cage's scores because they didn't have any other way to pay him.
Right.
So he had this huge collection of Cage scores, which he later gave to me, unfortunately. And so I have all of these older, you know, these early 1960 scores of Cage. Yeah. And it was interesting because Cage actually recopied some of them later, like a Metamorphosis. He recopied, you know, some of the very early things.
Did he introduce errors?
I don't know about that.
I see. But there's always that danger, you know.
there are errors in some Cage scores.
Sure.
And you know, you and I were talking a while back about the Etude Australis, because I had not learned a few of those. I play almost all of them because there were some unplayable things in them. They were just impossible to play. And then Steve Drury learned book three, and I think Steve has recorded that. And so I finally sent Steve a note. I said, how do you do this? You know, this particular thing.
Yeah.
And I sent him a photo of what I was talking about, and he sent a photo back and he said, problem solved. Well, the note I couldn't play wasn't in his score. It had been taken out. So apparently Greta Sultan, for whom they were written, consulted with Cage apparently and made some changes to the score, and Peters republished the Etudes, but there's nothing that says it's a corrected edition.
I see.
Unless you know what to look for, you don't know which version you have.
Terrible, terrible. We have actually in our collection here, we got the collection obviously from C.F. Peters, but in that collection from them are some of the early pieces that were published, you know, pre the standardized form. So we have some of what you're talking about. So I'm going to keep that in mind. If somebody writes to me and they're having trouble with a score, I'm going to say, what score are you using?
Yes. Yeah. And unfortunately with the Etudes, I think most university libraries have that first version. So
right.
We'll have to get on Gene's case to get them to say this is a corrected version now that's in print.
Exactly. No, it seems to me a good marketing strategy as well.
Absolutely.
They're losing, on the subject of C.F. Peters, they're losing James Joslin, their new music promotion fellow. He's stepping down at the end of this year. So it's been a transitional, you know, the year has been, this is going back to your question of whether or not they'll publish the few remaining things that are not published. It's hard to know, you know, to see how we all are, whether we're still standing in the same way that we were standing before COVID, because COVID is, you know, you can imagine what it did to, I mean, for the John Cage Trust, it hammered our income. It just hammered it. And C.F. Peters, even worse, because there were no rentals of scores or there were canceled. Nicholas Riddle actually told me, I wonder if this is okay to say, he told me that one of their largest sources of income in 2020, which was the first terrible year, was for cancellation fees.
Oh no, that's terrible.
Isn't that awful? Yeah. So their income just plummeted because there were no live performances. And even people who had rented scores and taken things on deposit canceled. And there was a cancellation fee associated when you did that. And so Nicholas said they had to impose that. Otherwise, they would have just gone under, period. So who knows? It remains to be seen whether or not we get to see that.
And so the trust receives royalties off of performances.
Almost exclusively, Tom. The John Cage Trust was formed as a nonprofit. We are definitely a nonprofit with our own, you know, 501c3. But we made a really steadfast decision that we were not going to become fundraisers. We were not going to go on the public dole because Cage never did. It just seemed wrong. There seemed something really bad about that. And also we didn't know how long we'd be in existence. It was really just to get things stabilized after Cage's death. But until COVID hit, we were totally self-sufficient, you know? And the income that we ever garnered was, no, I won't say 100%, but 85% of it was performance royalties. So that when live performance took a nosedive, so did our income, you know? Mm-hmm. So it almost flatlined. It was scary. And that happened for publishers, music publishers in particular, because nobody was performing. There was no income, so to speak. So it just remains to be seen what will happen, whether or not we can ever come back to, you know, where we were, or whether or not it just tanks. I don't know. I don't know. It's a funny time. It's a really funny time.
I certainly hope we come back.
Yeah. No, you and me both. Yeah. You and me both.
It was, but, you know, performing at in Asheville in October and November, it was fun and thrilling because I have not performed much in the past year and a half. Yep. And it was a packed house in November. You know, it was literally, it's not a big place, but it was standing room only. And it just felt sort of electric to be out in front of an audience again.
I can tell you, I felt that way being in the audience. It was like, oh my God, I can see, I could touch him if I wanted to. I could put my finger on him. We've all felt that way. I mean, just starved, you know, it's like Cage's feeling starved for nature in the 50s, you know, after he came back from his last time in Black Mountain. In fact, he said he was starved for nature and ended up joining the co-op in Stone.
Yes.
So he could be where mushrooms were and stone walls and swimming holes and all of that, you know.
You know, when I think about Cage and mushrooms, you know, those of us who are familiar with Cage and his art, his music, you know, his visual art, we think about his creative side, but he also had a scientific side and was really fascinated by not only fungi, but I think he said at one point, if he had to do it all over again, he would have been a botanist.
Uh-huh,
right? You know, and he loved that whole world, and he was like an encyclopedia. He could just rattle stuff off like crazy.
And, you know, he probably inherited some of that that enthusiasm from his father, you know, mm-hmm. who was an inventor, but his father hired him. We see it in the selected letters. There's some examples of it where he even gave some of the work that his father had given him to help him make a living before he was John Cage. His father had him translating other languages, and half of it was scientific. It was scientific language. And he pulled in Merce because Merce had no income. So yeah. Merce was doing this. He'd get like $7.50, a check for $7.50, which would feed him for a week, you know, back in the 40s. Anyway, yeah, so it's surprising. It led to a number, again, a little confusions that we're never gonna solve, I'm afraid. One of them is that one of the things that John gave Merce to do was to translate from Spanish into English these medical scientific journal pieces, which Merce did. I, nor anyone I know associated with Cunningham, ever heard Cunningham speak Spanish, ever. You know, not even a sentence. You know, I have a cold, nothing. So I just don't know how that happened. Like, you know.
Well, maybe he sat there with a dictionary and looked up maybe. Word by word what to say.
Maybe. And who knows, I mean, what Spanish, the translation like. Yes. And yeah. Spanish is not a hard language that way. It's not like the verb tenses sit at the end of the sentence kind of thing, you know, like in German or even in French. You know, you don't have things displaced in a sentence the same way. They're more like English. Anyway, we keep going off the beaten track into, you know, a strange new territory. But so you were going to do the 7 haiku, but you couldn't do the 7 haiku because there was no sostenuto pedal.
That's correct.
Yeah. So I know you had even forgotten that we
really have to have one. And I almost, and I, you know, you need one in water music too. And I was determined to play water music. So in that piece, I because I had these little rubber wedges that I use for the Etude Australis when I play them, I thought, well, I'll just very quickly hold some of those notes down with these wedges while I'm doing all this other stuff. So I figured out a way to do that with water music.
Right, to kind of fake a sostenuto effect.
Exactly, yes. Uh-huh. It was a little crazy, but it worked. But you really have to have one for those haiku. Huh. Cage really loved, for some reason in this time period, having notes that were sustained and then other more pointillistic notes on top.
Uh-huh, beautiful.
And often you hear, you know, harmonic reverberation from the notes that are sustained.
Sure.
And actually, you know,
the better the piano, the more true that is. Right.
Yes. And speaking of the Etude Australis, of course, you even hear that in those pieces, you know, those reverberating notes in the bass. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that happens a lot in not only in those haiku, but in Pastoral and other works from the early 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the haiku, in case we ran over that too quickly, these haiku come from both sets, the first set of five or seven, and the second set, so titled Seven Haiku, are absolutely, these are crossover works between Cage's pre-chance composition practice and his chance composition practice. And in fact, it's the seven haiku that actually use the same I Ching charts, derived charts from Music of Changes.
From Music of Changes, yes.
Yeah, so there's a direct connection between those two. Do you, now that you play them both, have you ever played the seven haiku publicly, Tom?
I have not.
Oh, you
have. So I was looking forward to playing them, but yeah. Some other time.
Maybe we can get you to come to Bard and you could do a Cage program for us.
I would love that.
We have a beautiful theater. We have several beautiful theaters. We should really seriously talk about that. But now that you have played them, at least for yourself, the second, and now publicly the first set, do you see relationship between the two? How do they differ? Where did Cage go with the seven haiku that he didn't go in the first set?
Well, I think the first set, to me, feel very expressive. You know, they seem much closer to his pre-chance work, if you will. In fact, the first of those haiku is quite tonal,
or, uh-huh.
You know, sounds to my ears rather tonal. And so they just feel like they're more closely associated with those earlier works. Whereas the second set of seven haiku, as you said, they derive from the same process that generated Music of Changes. And so they really feel very much in sort of that new world of chance operations that the first set didn't have.
It's interesting, isn't it? But they take the same form pretty much, right? They're both sets are short.
Yeah.
Single system.
They're tiny little pieces.
Yeah.
They're like,
so
they're like
the same form.
Just very short little things that come and go in a moment almost.
Do you remember the titles of the pieces in the set of five?
Yes, because I have the score right in front of
me. Oh, good. Read them. They're telling. I think the titles are telling.
They are telling. Well, the first one, and the first five of these are numbered. So Cage clearly thought of them as a set. And he says, let's see, the first one is Haiku for My Dear Friend Who.
Right. So for my dear friend, comma, who.
It's a capital W on the who. And Don thinks that may have been a reference to David Tudor.
Uh-huh.
But it's hard to know.
Yep.
And the second one is haiku two, and then in parentheses, what stillness, with an exclamation point. The third one is haiku three, the green frog's voice. Haiku four is the river Plurabelle, and that's a reference to Finnegan's Wake.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And the last one, haiku five, does not have a title.
Right.
Haiku five. And then the other haiku, the mysterious additional two haiku,
no titles,
maybe were written for Mauro, Jamie, and are not numbered. So.
And there's no reference to the additional two in Don's foreword beyond that there are an additional two.
Right.
Yeah.
He thinks one of them may have been a rejected, version of one that was rewritten.
Uh-huh.
So. But he really wasn't sure.
Yeah. And yeah. You played all seven, right?
I played just five.
You did.
I played the first one.
It would have totally confused me if you had played seven. And I don't remember being confused that night. So you must have only done five.
Because the sixth one also needs a sostenuto pedal.
I see. Only the sixth one?
So I thought, well, I can't play that. So I'm just going to leave off both of the... the extra ones.
No, that's smart. You would have had the irate director of the John Cage Trust coming up to you and saying, that's not the piece from 50 to 51. This is the seven haiku. You played seven haiku.
Anyway, they're really delightful. And I'm so glad
I love
that they've been published. Yeah.
I loved it. I loved it. We're going to have to come to an end soon, but I want to encourage you, if you can record them for us, we will put them in the program, because
all right. I would
they
love
really
to do
belong
that.
There. They belong there. It'd be really nice. And I'm going to poke around and see what else of yours that you've played that might be nice. Maybe the Etudes Australes, a couple of them, maybe.
Sure. I love those pieces.
Yeah,
they're so much beautiful. Fun to play.
They're beautiful. Yeah. And you're much more congenial than Greta.
You know, when I was in graduate school, I had a student colleague friend, Laura Fletcher, who was studying with Greta. And so we were able to get her down to the University of Maryland to do the American premiere of books 3 and 4.
Uh-huh.
And this must have been 1983 or 1984. So it took her, 8 years to learn them, before premiering
right.
them. She had given the premiere in Japan.
Right.
But I remember, and I wish I knew where they were, but her scores had these almost like phrase marks written into them. And as I recall, different colors here and there. I thought, what is that? So that was way before I learned them.
I'm wondering, yeah. I may have someone in my address book who might know where they went, like Beatrice Roman. Does that name mean anything to you?
Yes.
Yeah, so Beatrice might know or even have them. It's possible that Greta just gave them to her. Maybe.
Yeah. Anyway. That would be amazing to see. Yeah.
We'll look. Well, so Tom, it's just been a pleasure to talk with you. I really would like to propose another program with you, and that is perhaps doing a program about As Slow as Possible and Organ 2 As Slow as Possible. Wouldn't that be fun? And we could bring in the producer of the long piece, the long version of the piece, Halberstadt. Maybe do a three-way conversation with him as well. And we could talk about the birth of the piece with you and then the elongation of the piece with Rainer Neugebauer.
I'd love that.
Okay, good.
That would be fabulous.
Thank you so much. We'll be talking in the next day and a half while we concoct some music for this program.
All right. Good to see you, Laura.
And you, Tom. My love to Marjorie. Now let's listen to Tom's new rendition of Cage's early haikus from 1950 to 51, which he first performed in Asheville for the 12th annual Reviewing Black Mountain College International Conference on November 12th of this year. He later recorded it, last Sunday to be exact, expressly for All Things Cage at Linehan Concert Hall at the University of Maryland, Baltimore campus with recording engineer Alan Wanaberger. Cage's haikus were not published until after Cage's death, and at the time, Edition Peter's associate, Don Gillespie, served as its editor. He clarified the work for many, explaining that in 1950-51, quote, John Cage composed not 5, but 7 haiku for piano. The manuscripts are extremely sketchy, but can be deciphered, with only a few minor rhythmic details open to speculation. In contrast to the familiar 7 haiku of 1951-52, which Cage copied out carefully and later published, these earlier haiku used the sequence of 7 plus 5 plus 7 sound events in 9 measures as a structural underpinning, rather than the 5 plus 7 plus 5 sequence of the later composition. One wonders whether Cage would have eventually found time to recopy these little pieces for publication. They reflect a fascinating musical path from the almost tonal haiku 1, reflecting a language similar to the 16 dances of the same years, to a completely atonal style akin pitch-wise to the music of Changes from 1951, but without ostensibly using chance methodology. The first of the 4 volumes of Music of Changes was completed on May 15, 1951, 2 months after haiku 5. The dates of these early haiku confirm the powerful influence on Cage of the Zen Buddhist master Daisetsu Taitaro Suzuki, who gave 3 lectures at Columbia University in March 1951. It cannot be a coincidence that Cage composed haiku 2, 3, 4, and 5 during that same month. The titles of the pieces present a number of puzzles for the transcriber. Although using literary themes similar to those found in traditional Japanese haiku, a dear friend, stillness, frogs. No specific allusion to Japanese haiku in print in 1950 can be found. Haiku 4 references the River Plurabelle of Joyce's Finnegan's Wake. The dear friend referred to in the title of Haiku 1 might be David Tudor, whom Cage had met at the beginning of 1950 and who, it is said, once performed this piece. One should note that the initial 1.5 measures of the piece appear on the title page of Cage's manuscript for 16 Dances from 1551. Though no thematic reference to 16 Dances has been found. Curiously, the manuscript of Haiku 5 contains Arnold Schoenberg's Los Angeles address in its right-hand margin. The sixth haiku is untitled and undated, but was also likely composed in March 1951. An alternative version of the first haiku, undated, seems to have been rejected. These two pieces are included here as addenda. That's close quote, Don Gillespie, editor of the published score. Now let's listen to Tom Moore, who plays all seven haiku as reflected in the previous comments. Thank you.